How are you? Welcome back to Ellie 2.0 Radio, where you're talking to me, Ellie, without the 2.0, although that is part of the story. Ellie 2.0, where we talk about idealism and idealists and the need for positive change in the world. And because, as we all know, we're certainly desperate, right? In desperate need for positive change. You know that. I know that. Today we have an Ellie's Talking Head show. That's because I don't have an interview to share with you. I just couldn't get a guest booked. It's been a busy week. But no worries. Don't worry. I have a lot to share, and I'm positive that you'll walk away being happy that you listened to this radio show and podcast. I'm positive about that. But let's begin with this week's featured idealist, Edward R. Murrow. That might be a name very familiar to him. I'm highlighting him because yesterday, Friday, May 3rd, was World Press Freedom Day. And certainly when you think about the journalists and think about the press, particularly broadcast journalism, I mean, one of the greats, like one of the greatest greats, is Edward R. Murrow. Now, I know that Murrow's name is one of that many of you will recognize, but I'm equally certain that there are some things about him that will surprise you. To begin, Edward R. Murrow was born in 1908 in North Carolina in a log cabin that lacked running water and electricity. Yeah, believe it or not, okay? His family was Quaker. When he was a young child, his family moved from North Carolina to northern Washington State, where they homesteaded just 30 miles south of the Canadian border. So they were way, way up into the woods. Eventually, Murrow attended and graduated from Washington State University with a degree in speech. When he was just 21 years old, he attended the annual convention of the National Student Federation of America. And there he gave a speech urging students to become more interested in national affairs. Sounds like the kind of thing an idealist would have somebody do. And that led him to becoming the president of the National Student Federation. Now, after college graduation, so Murrow early on wants to go to college. He wants to learn about speech. He wants to be able to learn how to argue and to clearly enunciate positions. And so by the time he gets out of college, he goes to New York City. So he goes all the way across the country where this was just as Hitler was coming to power. He served as the assistant secretary of the Emergency Committee in Aid of Displaced Foreign Scholars. And in that role, he helped German scholars who were being dismissed from academic positions. Now, drawing a parallel to that, to what's happening in the United States right now. So Hitler's starting to come to power. You know, the Germany is starting to change, you know, and scholars, many of them Jewish, but not all of them, because people, you know, many of these scholars were, you know, academics. They were saying things that were inconsistent with what was the party line. And of course, we can draw parallels to what's happening in America right now, because many diversity, equity, and inclusion professionals within academic institutions, I mean, I think at this point it's something like 10 or 12 states have banned DEI for their state university systems. They're all losing their jobs. Just throwing that in there for a little perspective. After serving in that role, helping displaced scholars, Murrow got really lucky. When he was just 27 years old, he got hired by CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System. Remember, it was all radio then. And he got hired as its director of talks and education. His job was to line up guests for the network, something that Elie Krug could positively use, okay? And so the network has, you know, they did not have any broadcast journalists per se. What the network had were radio hosts who were bring people into interviews. So they didn't have anybody like doing commentary. In 1937, CBS sent Edward R. Murrow to London to serve as the network's director of European operations. And so by 37, he's 29 years old. I mean, geez, okay? And his job in London was to hire journalists to report from various European capitals. So CBS is trying to set up this network of journalists who could do broadcast, remote broadcasts from various European capitals. Parenthetically, one of the journalists that Edward R. Murrow hired was William L. Scherer, who I have something in common with. Both he and I are graduates of Coe College in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. In fact, he is Coe College's most famous alum, William Scherer. While in London, Edward R. Murrow and his network of journalists, the network was dubbed the Murrow Boys, reported on how Nazi Germany was doing its thing. They reported on it annexing Austria and then the Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia. Of course, Murrow gained great notoriety as the German invasion progressed to the point where the London Blitz occurred. So that occurred from September of 1940 to May of 1941. In fact, after World War II broke out entirely, so after the U.S. is entirely in it, Murrow flew, now get this, okay? He flew on 25 Allied combat missions over Europe. And as he's in the planes, he was making recordings to broadcast back on the bombers. I mean, I don't know if you've been following, you know, the Steven Spielberg, Tom Hanks show on whatever it is, Apple, about, you know, the bombers in World War II, but the rate of being shot down on those bombers was incredible. I mean, there were flight crews that were suffering horrible, horrible casualties. And Edward R. Murrow, he had to have known that. And still he goes out, not on one, not on two, but on 25 bomber missions. Incredible, okay? While in London, Murrow adopted his signature sign-off, which is good night and good luck. And that was a phrase that Londoners were using during the Blitz. And the reason they were saying that was because they weren't certain that come morning they'd all be alive. Good night and good luck. Okay? At the end of the war, Murrow returned to the U.S. and became the vice president of CBS and the head of CBS News. Again, he's a young man. He's got all of this prestige because he was an incredible journalist reporting facts, giving people through radio, through words, giving them a sense of what it felt like to be in the space where he was, where he was reporting. Beginning in 1947, Murrow started hosting various programs on CBS, including from 1951 to 1955. This I Believe, which let just regular people speak on the radio for 5 minutes. Maybe we should try. I'm just a regular person speaking on the radio, but you have me for an hour. How do you like that? By 1951, Murrow had converted to television, and he was doing a show titled See It Now, which focused on controversial issues. I mean, Murrow, he was not, you know, he's not a guy that was going to go talk about bunny rabbits at Easter. Okay, he was not that kind of guy. Okay, and in 1951, we have another demagogue surfacing, and his name was Joe McCarthy. And Edward R. Murrow understood this. I mean, he had just seen it not more than 15 years or so before that. He understood what was going on with Joe McCarthy and McCarthy's Red Scare, okay, that McCarthy and his followers were fomenting. All right, we're going to get to something here. In March of 1954, Murrow's See It Now did a half-hour report on how Senator McCarthy had repeatedly contradicted himself, and that report made McCarthy seem like a heck of a hypocrite. CBS was so afraid of that half-hour thing, that half-hour piece on McCarthy, that CBS didn't promote the program. CBS wasn't saying, coming up, this big program about Senator McCarthy, Joe McCarthy. And so Edward R. Murrow spends his own money to take an ad out in the paper to let everybody know on the upcoming See It Now show, I take on Joe McCarthy. Think of the fear of how afraid people were. Now, we can draw some parallels again. Think of the fear of how scared people were of Joe McCarthy and his group, okay? All right, so Edward R. Murrow does that show, highlighting how McCarthy's a hypocrite, how he's contradicted himself. And in that show, he invited McCarthy to come on. And a month later, on April 6, 1954, Joe McCarthy accepted Edward R. Murrow's invitation to be on Murrow's show. And on that show, see it now, in April of 1954, 70 years ago, McCarthy went ahead, and of course you knew what he was going to do. He accused Edward R. Murrow of being a communist and a socialist. So again, that's 70 years ago. Think of the parallels, okay? Who else attacks people who are attacking them and then labels them as communists, as left-wingers? Who else does that? It's far-left radicals. Who else is doing that in contemporary America right now? Then a week later, after McCarthy came onto Murrow's show, okay, and attacked him as a communist, a week later, Murrow responded to that on the next See It Now episode, all right? Okay, and Brett's going to play here. So McCarthy, he's got this big piece he puts on there Murrow puts this big piece on about McCarthy, and Brett's going to play a little bit more than a minute and a half of Edward R. Murrow responding to McCarthy's claims. You're going to get in the middle of the show, okay? You're not getting like from the beginning. You're going to get the end though. And he's responding to McCarthy's claims that he, Edward R. Murrow, is a communist. Listen up. Thank you, Brett.
Another charge by Senator McCarthy was that Owen Lattimore mentioned me in a book. What Lattimore said in substance was that he had never met me, but that I had done a fair job of reporting his testimony. In short, that I had not presumed his guilt. Everything I said on that case is a matter of record and can be examined by anyone who is interested. I hope to continue to present evidence developed before congressional committees as impartially as I am able. And that specifically includes the hearings before which Senator McCarthy is shortly scheduled to appear. I have worked for CBS for more than 19 years. The company has subscribed fully to my integrity and responsibility as a broadcaster and as a loyal American. I require no lectures from the junior senator from Wisconsin as to the dangers or terrors of communism. Having watched the aggressive forces at work in Western Europe, having had friends in Eastern Europe butchered and driven into exile, having broadcast from London in 1943 that the Russians were responsible for the Katyn massacre, having told the story of the Russian refusal to allow Allied aircraft to land on Russian fields after dropping supplies to those who rose in Warsaw and then were betrayed by the Russians, and having been denounced by the Russian radio for these reports, I cannot feel that I require instruction from the senator on the evils of communism. Having searched my conscience and my files, I cannot contend that I have always been right or wise, but I have attempted to pursue the truth with some diligence and to report it, even though, as in this case, I had been warned in advance that I would be subjected to the attentions of Senator McCarthy. We shall hope to deal with matters of more vital interest to the country next week. Good night and good luck.
Wow. You heard him say, I was told if I took on McCarthy, I would be attacked. And he still took him on. Can you imagine the bravery? I mean, you know, we're all too old to have lived through the Red Scare. But people were losing their jobs. People were committing suicide. People were being arrested. All because of Joe McCarthy, of what he was doing. And you have this journalist, Edward R. Murrow, one of the most respected men in America, take him on. The degree of courage and bravery by that idealist, unbelievable. Unbelievable. The rest of the story is that Edward R. Murrow died of lung cancer. Apparently he was a prolific smoker, smoking three packs of cigarettes, unfiltered Camels, a day for most of his life. And he died 2 days after his 57th birthday, taken away from us. One other note, Tufts University, outside of Boston, established the Edward R. Murrow Center of Public Diplomacy in his name. What a great legacy. So, when you think about the greats, okay, when you think about those who helped shape journalism and shaped it in such a way with bravery and courage and integrity and relying on facts and not the kind of crap that we see coming out of Fox News these days, okay? Think about Edward R. Murrow. Think about him and how he set the legacy for the rest of the country. And me, you know, some hack journalist, that's, I put myself in that category. But nonetheless, just like him, I am trying to do the right thing. Okay, I hope you enjoyed that about our featured idealist, Edward R. Murrow. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'm going to talk about something else. We'll be back in a second. Thanks. We're back. Your favorite hack journalist, Ellie Krug here, Ellie 2.0 Radio. So Edward R. Murrow, I just, you know, I can't say enough the esteem I have for that man. I do. So, all right. Let's talk along the same lines, okay, of, you know, of a government, you know, of an entity of nationalism, what was happening in Germany, and then nationalism again that was happening in the U.S. in the 1950s. Let me bring you forward here to talk about another form of oppression, of marginalization. And, of course, that's what's going on with transgender people in America right now. And I've got some good news, and then I've got some bad news. So let me give you the good news real quick, and then we'll do the bad news. So the good news is this, is that the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals this week upheld transgender person's constitutional right to access health care, gender-affirming care, and then shut down laws in North Carolina and I think South Carolina that prevented people from accessing health care and being able to, for example, get gender affirming care through Medicare. And the Fourth Circuit's ruling really seemed to take on some of the rationale that was in the Dobbs case, because the Dobbs case is the one that's got the biggest problem that we have, because in Dobbs, the Supreme Court essentially ignored the individual right to privacy that Roe v. Wade was premised on. And it is that individual right to privacy that allowed gay people to marry, that allowed gay people to have gay sex without getting arrested for it, which allowed transgender people to hopefully be able to access gender-affirming care and live as who they are. So the Fourth Circuit, good job, Fourth Circuit, but it's setting up a division in the circuits, which ultimately the Supreme Court's going to handle, and I don't know how that's going to come out. Trust me, I really don't know, and I'm afraid of how that will come out. So that's good news for circuit. Here's some bad news. One of the bad news is that this week the Biden administration issued Title IX regulations that were protecting transgender people, and four states right out immediately have said that they were not going to abide by the Title IX regulations protecting transgender students in public schools and public universities. Texas and Oklahoma are two of those states. I think Florida is the third. I don't remember what the fourth state is. Stay tuned. There are going to be more states that are going to refuse to do that. We're setting it up that the Justice Department then is going to have to, you know, file lawsuits to enforce Title IX protecting transgender students in those states. And of course, if 2025 or 2024 goes the wrong way, all of that litigation will go out the door. Okay, so though, you know, that's not good news, okay, that we have states that are refusing to follow Title IX. And then I want to just report on Utah. So this is coming from Erin Reed. You know, I've had Erin Reed. She's a transgender blogger and activist. She is like the best in the whole country keeping track of what's going on with legislative moves that affect transgender people. And so this is from her blog, Erin in the Morning. So I want to make sure I give her credit there. And she wrote about Utah, which a couple of months ago or last month, I can't keep track of it all. But, you know, the governor signed legislation outlawing the right of transgender people to use public restrooms that accord with their gender identity. So, for example, the next time I fly through the Salt Lake City airport and I need to use the restroom, under Utah law, I am supposed to use the men's restroom. That's the way it is in Utah right now. I'm supposed to use the, that I would have to use the men's restroom in Utah. How do you like that? Well, anyway, apparently the government in Utah decided that they were going to open up with a snitch line that you know, you can phone in, okay, or write in. You have to fill out a form, but you can email it, okay, or text it, you know, this form about you seeing a transgender person in another, you know, in a space like a restroom or like a locker room or wherever, and you're, you know, and they want photographic evidence. So you got to pull out your camera. If you see Ellie Krug in the women's restroom at the Salt Lake City airport, you're supposed to pull out your camera, take a picture of me, and I'll be smiling. Hi, how are you? And then you're supposed to send that picture in, okay, with all the circumstances. Yeah, she scared the heck out of me because she was standing there washing her hands. It was horrible. Oh, my God, I have the trauma. And apparently under this law, you know, if a facility fails to enforce the law, they can get fined $10,000 per failure to enforce. So, I mean, so there's this financial incentive for all of these, you know, state agencies, state places that have, like, restrooms and all that kind of stuff. You know, like, you're going to the, you know, the county office and using the restroom. Well, Ellie Krug can't do that in using the women's restroom. I mean, so there are all these incentives to snitch on people. But as Erin also reports, which I thought was quite lovely, this snitch line is already being flooded, you know, with people sending memes and sending, you know, apparently there's something out of the B-movie that, like the Disney B-movie, apparently there's something out of that movie's, you know, some of the dialogue in that movie, which apparently is, I don't know, it's supposed to relate in some way to all of this. And so, of course, and other states have tried to do snitch lines as well, and they haven't really worked, and they've been shut down. We'll see how well Utah's goes, okay? And next time I'm going to Salt Lake City, though, I'll let you all know, and we can all, you know, maybe I'll have to videotape my restroom visits to see what happens. I don't know. It's kind of crazy, folks, and I have no idea, literally no idea, of how much worse it's going to get. All right, we're going to take a break right now. When I come back, I'm going to talk to you about the college protests. I think I need to say something at this point. All right, you're listening to me, Ellie Krug on Ellie 2.0 Radio. One of the few, no, the only idealistic transgender radio podcast host in the world. That would be me. Thanks. We'll be back in a sec. And I'm back. Ellie 2.0 Radio. You know, I hope you're enjoying this talking head. I know that I don't have an interview. I will next week, assuming my guest comes through for me. And I think you will like her. She is quite the idealist, and it's somebody that I know, and I think that you'll enjoy her. But otherwise, I hope that the fact that it's a talking head, you're just listening to me drone on, nah, 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 nah. I hope that it's okay, all right, for this time around. And if it isn't, send me an email. Let me know. Ellie, I don't like the talking head shows. Don't do them anymore. So, oh, my email, by the way, is ellejkrug, K-R-U-G, at gmail.com. All right. I am going to wade into an area that I have great trepidation about, but I'm going to do it. And that would be the college protests going on right now. I mean, University of Minnesota, which is, you know, 35 miles away. They've been having protests for the last 2 weeks. I think that yesterday or today they made some kind of agreement that the university would look at divestiture of various investments that are supportive of Israel. I don't know. Let me lay the foundation for this in a couple of ways. First of all, I was born in New Jersey and lived in New Jersey for a while till I was 11 years old. And my father worked in New York City, so he commuted from our home in New Jersey to New York City every day. And at his workplace were a lot of Jewish people. In fact, his bosses were Jewish. And my father had a habit of inviting people over to the house for dinner. And I vividly remember he brought one man came over to visit. And I remember this in part because he brought me a model. He brought me a model of the USS Nautilus, the first atomic submarine. I remember him bringing it. He brought that to me as a gift, which was very sweet of him. But he also brought one of those projectors. Now, older folks, you know what I'm going to talk about. Younger people, you have no idea what this is. Remember, it was the carousel, and you would put the slides that you would take of pictures, and then you'd have this carousel on top of a projector, and then you'd have to have a screen. You know, you have to bring the projector and the carousel and the screen, and then you hit a clicker, and it would click from slide to slide to slide. Well, this man had visited Israel before he came to visit us at our house, and so he brought pictures of Israel. And this was before the 1967 war when the borders changed, and so the West Bank was still part of original Palestinian territory, and there was I just remember the pictures of barbed wire and just of what Israel looked like. And then when my family moved from New Jersey out to Iowa, my father brought some Jewish folks with him to help set up the office and staff the office, and those folks were over at my house for Sunday dinner, you know, and I got exposed to Jewish people early on. And then, of course, I went to law school in Boston. I got hired at a law firm that had a lot of Jewish folks. In fact, with the last name of Krug, for a while they thought I was Jewish. And I started getting solicitations for various Jewish causes. And then since then, I've gone on, of course, and met other folks that are Jewish and have Jewish friends. I have a very dear Jewish friend in New Jersey who keeps me abreast of what's going on in her community. She talks to me about how, you know, they have to have bomb barriers at her synagogue, how they have to have armed guards. You know, I mean, the stuff that, you know, people out here in Minnesota, when you go and worship, you don't have any of that stuff, okay? And that brings us to October 7th, you know, and what the atrocities that Hamas committed in Gaza, the hostage taking. No right group of humans takes human hostages. They don't. And then, of course, you know, I mean, horror, just absolute horror that Hamas committed. I am absolutely, I'm not, you know, I did, there's no, it's just horrible, monstrous. And then, of course, we have the military operation against Gaza, in which, I don't know, is somewhere between 30 and 40,000 Gazans have died, of which more than 10,000 were children. You know, and I want to make sure that everyone understands what I have to say here about the college protests. First, Israel has the right to exist. Secondly, Israel has the right to defend itself. OK, Okay? Absolutely. They have the right to do that. However, I am mindful of this one fact that I don't care how good your military is. I don't care how good your cause is. But for every child that you kill, you produce two people who want to take retribution. That is a fact. America learned, we learned this rule in Iraq and in Afghanistan. We did. I don't know if we fully learned it, but we certainly experienced that rule. And I am absolutely, you know, supportive of our college students who are protesting the utter degree of bombing and destruction of Gaza that Israel has been taking out on Gazans. Okay, I think college students have the right to support the Palestinian people. I think they have the right to, you know, to take issue with all of the destruction. They do. They do not, in my view, have the right to support Hamas. They certainly don't have the right to call for the destruction of Israel. They certainly don't have the right to call for any type of violence against Jewish students who are in their schools. And I will readily admit it is a fine line about free speech, about advocating for ideas and positions that, while painful, are still positions that are protected by free speech. I am not in favor, though, of anti-Semitism. I am not in favor of calling for Jewish students to in some way be harmed or hurt, either emotionally or physically. And so what we are seeing on our college campuses right now, I think, it's a mixture of some idealism by the students. That's why I'm talking about it on this show. I think it's some degree, maybe a larger degree, of naivete about trying to make a complicated, very historically complicated situation into a black and white situation, which I think isn't possible. But I will tell you, I mean, I am in favor of a two-state solution. I am not in favor of Netanyahu. I don't think the man, I mean, he has put the United States in very, very difficult situations. And he certainly may, by what he is doing, may affect the U.S. election. Because if Joe Biden loses the youth vote, we got a lot of problems, okay? I mean, it's a good idea of how 2024 is going to go come November. And so, bottom line is this. I absolutely affirm the students' rights to protest the destruction of what's going on in Gaza, the extent of the destruction, the death of 10,000 children, absolutely, which appears to be, you know, as I talked about several weeks ago about the aid workers from World Central Kitchen, about the not, you know, just the careless, negligent way that people are being killed. But under no circumstances should anyone ever call for the destruction of a country or its people or their religion on both sides of the equation. Okay? All right. Well, I just waded in. Hopefully, and if you disagree with me in some way, please email me. Hopefully my Jewish friends will understand that I am supportive of them. I care about them. They are incredibly important to me. I want to affirm them, okay, my Jewish friends. But there's, in my view, and I know that this will be a hot point, I do view the difference between the Jewish religion and the Israeli government. I do view that there is a difference between the two. And right now, the Israeli government in a variety of ways is creating, in my view, far more problems than what it is solving. And it is pulling us, America, into those problems. Okay, well, there you go. Hopefully, we'll see, all right? But I need to speak about it because it's going on right now in our country. And it's some of it's because idealists are at work. All right, when we come back from our break, I got some other stuff to talk with you about, a little bit of stuff from my heart. And you're listening to me, Ellie Krug from Ellie 2.0 Radio. I hope what you like. If you like what you hear, go visit my website at elliekrug.com. Follow me. You can follow me. I'm still on Twitter. You can follow me on Threads. You can follow me on Instagram, although I don't check all those all that much. We'll be back in a sec. Thanks. And we're back. Ellie 2.0 Radio. Okay. All right. So last segment, we talk about some stuff that I've been doing, and then I'll share something from the heart for you. Okay? So you may remember a couple of weeks ago, I don't know how long ago, I had Sarah and Elise on the show from, they were together with me. We were the co-founders of Carver County Pride. You remember that? They were just so fun to interview. And, you know, two idealists at work. Well, you know, this Carver County Pride, we filed a corporation for it. I got a tax ID number this week. I'm going to go get the 501c3 hopefully done for our charitable status. But we got a board of six people. They're all doers. And we have a date for the very first Carver County-wide, okay, for like the whole county. Carver County Pride event in Carver County, red to purple, Carver County, Minnesota. And that will take place on Saturday, August 31, 2024. Now, if you want to support us, if you want, for example, if you're a business and you want to come and table, if you're a food truck and you want to be here, there at our event, reach out to me. Or better yet, just go to Carver County Pride. Just all you have to do is Google Carver County Pride because it's carvercountypride.com. And you can find information, fill out forms, and figure out how you can be supportive that way. If you want to write a check to support this organization, that would be wonderful as well, okay? And you can send that check to AM 950, courtesy of Ellie, you know, and attention Ellie Krug. Or email me at lejkrug@gmail.com, and I'll give you my home address, and you can send the check to us if you want to be supportive of Carver County Pride. And your check, I am positive we're going to get our 501c3, so I'm hopeful that, you know, we're going to get it. I can't say that we have to get it, certainly, but if we get it, you know, it'll be, you know, tax deductible. So I'm thrilled that we're going to do that, and that is just, you know, it's just a bunch of people getting together saying we're going to go have our Pride. So, and it's going to be at the... Oh, I should tell you, it's going to be in Waconia, all right, on Saturday, August 31st in Waconia, Minnesota, at the fairgrounds. So this is like the county fairgrounds. It is like a countywide pride because right now in Carver County, Chaska has a pride, but it's for the Chaska. And it's not run by an organization made up of queer people. I mean, it's put on by the Human Rights Commission, which does wonderful work in Chaska. I'm not trying to criticize them. But this pride, the pride that we're going to do in Waconia, is a pride run by queer people, for queer people, and for our allies, and for anybody else who wants to come and enjoy and have a great day. Okay? So, and we're going to have music. We're going to have food trucks. We're going to have food. We're going to have booths. We're going to have... It'll be fun. Okay, so get that on your calendar, Saturday, August 31, and you'll hear about me talk about that more and more as we go on, okay, as we get closer. Now, personal note, two personal notes. One is, off and on, I've been talking about the fact that I'm writing a sequel to my book. My first book that's out is Getting to Ellen, a memoir about love, honesty, and gender change. And I'm writing a sequel to that, okay, because it's a continuation of the story. And that book is titled getting or being Ellen. Okay, first was getting to Ellen. The second is being Ellen, and I don't know what the rest of the title would be. Probably something about grabbing a second chance or something like that at life. But I've been working on that book, and I've been working a lot on that book every day, 2 or 3 hours every day. It's progressing. I hope that this time next year, that book is out. That would be really great if we got it out in time for Pride of 2025. That's assuming there will be prides in 2025. And that sounds, you know, kind of morose for me to say that, but the election in November is that big. All right. On a more personal note, let's see. Tuesday of this week was April 30th. And that is a special, you know, in my mind, in the Elie Krug constellation of dates, that's a pretty important date. Because this Tuesday was the 20th anniversary of me starting my life as Elie Krug. I had, as you may know, if you've read my book, I married my high school sweetheart. We had two beautiful daughters, lived in the best neighborhood in Cedar Rapids. And I went for a long time suppressing my identity. But on April 30th of 2004, I moved out of my house, the house that I had remodeled several times with my wife, the house that my daughters only knew. And I moved out of that house on that day. I went and I had some privilege and I was able to buy a new house. And that became the place where I started a long, long journey that took, you know, it wasn't until May of 2009 that I actually transitioned genders and changed my name and appearance. But for 5 years between 2004 and 2009, I was living in that house, trying to figure out exactly who I was, exploring the world, and making some good memories. It was a beautiful, beautiful house. But it's a bittersweet day. Even though I got to be me and I got to go take this journey that I'm still on right now as you're listening to me, I'm on this journey. I am on this journey of exploration, this journey of figuring out what exactly the universe has in store for me. Even though that's been an incredible journey, it's bittersweet because the life I had in that house before I left it, it was a beautiful life with a beautiful woman and beautiful children. And I'm not, it's just hard to have lost all that. Okay, there we go. All right, that's the end of this Talking Head show. Big thanks to my producer, Brett Johnson. Thank you again, Brett, for doing a lot of math today and helping out with everything as always. To you, my listeners, I hope that it wasn't too much information I just gave to you, okay? And to everyone else, okay, share about this show. I'd like to make sure, see if we can get this bigger and bigger. We'll see. In the meantime, go out and do something good to make the world better, will you? Between now and when you hear my voice again. Elie Krug, over and out.